Get it right this time, yeah?
Yeah, I will, yeah. Yeah, but here we go. All right, it's the Gifted Gamer podcast, and on this week's episode, we're finally able to do our games club of Clair Obscur's Expedition 33. It's all ahead of us here on this week's episode of the Gifted Gamer podcast. Hey, it's me, your host, Darren Wade, and today I'm joined by Craig, the critical Nolan, my fellow expeditioner, Craig. How are you today?
I'm pretty good, Darren. I don't think I'll be as critical today as usual, but, you know, we'll see how it goes.
Is that because you just love the game we're going to talk about so much?
Yes, almost universally, yeah. It's one of those ones, so it's going to be hard to I mean, I am going to criticize, you know, make no mistake, but, like, this is a very, very good game, yeah. And I'm still beaming with joy every time I play it.
Before we get into our... I wouldn't exactly say, I mean, our review, but our chat, like, you and me haven't finished the game. We're both very much at the epilogue of the game, kind of around the same point. But before I get into it, I have a gripe I'd like to pick with Nintendo. Just before you came up Before you came up here, before we started doing this episode, I was looking at, like, ordering the Switch 2 GameCube controller. Because my GameCube controller that I have for the Switch 1 is broken. I can't seem to get it fixed. I was like, okay, maybe I'll invest in this other one. In order to order it, you have to sign into your Nintendo account. And unfortunately, my laptop, for whatever reason, doesn't remember whatever it was. I don't remember the password, so I did the usual, hey, forgot my password, Nintendo, send me that, like, link to reset it. Got the link and it said, oh, you want to reset your password? Give us the Google Authenticator 6-digit code. And I was like, oh, okay. Open up my phone. There I have Google Authenticator attached to my email. Enter the code. Not valid. Enter the code. Waited for it to refresh about 6 or 7 times. Entered the code each time. Doesn't work. I was like, okay, well, what can I do now? It's like, well, you can't use your authenticator code. Try this. And then it was asking me for my backup Nintendo IDs, which I remember I got sent like fucking 5, 6, 7 years ago around the time of the Switch, where they give you a list of like 20 codes and you can use each of them once to access your thing. I have no idea where they're saved. And because I have no idea where they're saved, I cannot log into my Nintendo account right now. Okay. I have tried all the support things. It's all stupid AI fucking bots telling me, does this answer your question? I was like, fuck no. I still can't get into my account. So I am so annoyed that something as simple as I forgot my password, give me a verification thing to change my password, is no longer acceptable.
Did you feel like it was necessary to tell me that of all people? Because I'm the critical Craig person. Is that why you wanted to get that off your chest? Because I'm like, that's so unlike you. They just... you know, just start complaining right out the gate. I'm like, am I like rubbing off on you? Yeah, or something?
Maybe,
like,
maybe
well,
a little
what
bit.
Happened
it
there?
Was just, it was just that I was like, you know, before the podcast, I was like, oh, I'll do this thing. I'll order the controller.
Just
that'll
buy
be
it
nice.
In the shops.
But will they have it in the shops? That's the thing.
Probably, yeah.
Because the only place you can order from currently, the only place I could see that it was available to order from was from Nintendo.
Just get an Amazon account.
maybe.
I mean, maybe. Just do it.
Yeah, I guess. The only problem is I don't think I can, and I haven't now, okay, I haven't done a whole lot of searching in this, okay, but I don't know if I can order it from anywhere else until June 5th. So Nintendo allows you to pre-order the controller, so it'll like be put, you know, sent out to you for release day. I don't need that for release day. It was just one of those things I was ahead of the thinking of, but I don't know if I can order pre-order the controller from anyone else.
I don't know. The GameCube controller, just so you know, is overrated. Like, you know, the C-stick is in a terrible position. It's useless for first-person shooters. So if you're ever to play one of those,
it's just for Smash Bros.
Bad out of luck.
It's just for Smash Bros.
Just for
Smash.
Okay. It's just for Smash Bros. Just for Smash Bros. That's fine. You can borrow mine in the meantime. Okay.
Yeah, I guess it's just not, you know. Yeah, I couldn't believe how difficult it was for me to fucking change my password.
That's just companies. Like, that could have been anyone. Like, you lose your password for any company ever and you might get something like that, like, you know.
But I've got like 2-step authenticating stuff for a good few things, you know, to log into my network in the job. I have a 2-step authenticator. All those authenticators work.
Okay, in my job they don't. They never work. Well, I hate them all.
Okay, yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So like, it's just whenever this happens, no matter who it is, It's awful.
It's just going to be a shit time.
You're going to have a bad day.
But now I'm worried I can't log into my... So I can buy a Nintendo GameCube controller maybe from someone else. That's not the problem. My worry is I can't log into my Nintendo account that I've had for years and years and years. And I'm just like, oh, now, in fairness, they don't do the points.
Need it for anything.
They don't do the point system anymore, yeah, which is fair. But I don't know. I'd like to go in there, maybe check some of... I don't even know what information is available there.
I'll log into mine and show you, but I haven't logged on to my Nintendo since I got the Switch.
Like, yeah.
There's no reason for me to do so.
I think I logged in. There was a time where they were doing like a points or a coins system and you could get free stuff. I think I got a Zelda coin sent out to me at one
point. A
coin? Yeah, remember, you know.
That sounds terrible.
It wasn't worth it, man.
Pointless. You're better off, man, in the long run.
That was my gripe. I mean, listen, before we get, are you playing anything else other than Clair Obscur's Exhibition 33?
Taking all my, I was trying to get through it so that I could do like a full review, but I like haven't. I have to, there's just, it turns out there's way more side content, you know, in typical Final Fantasy
or end game, yeah, end game content,
yeah,
really,
like content before the final boss, yeah, you know. So I didn't want to complete it yet. I wanted to do all that stuff. So I probably played about 60-70 hours, but it's just not enough, you know, because I want to do so much and there's so much there.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to give an official score, but I am going to give a score.
I've finished the game official score, but yeah, not giving the same boat. Right. Well, I suppose, Craig, we might as well get into it. I'm sure we'll have plenty to talk about. So today on the Gift of Gaming Games Club, we're talking about Clair Obscur Expedition 33. This is a 2025 turn-based role-playing game developed by French studio Sandfall Interactive and published by Kepler Interactive. Very much inspired by the likes of, I'd say,
Persona 5.
Final Fantasy X.
I'm a massive fan of Persona 5. And like the UI is just taken straight from Persona 5. What they did do, and what the Persona team need to do, because that's Atlas, they're... What was Atlas's follow-up game to Persona 5? The one
we Phantasium or something like that?
No.
Metaphor. Re-Fantasio.
Everyone loves that game. Whereas this, like, as good as that game was, and it was even nominated for Game of the Year and stuff like that, like, Clair Obscur shits all over that. Like, in every way. It's way better. And it's mainly because the combat from Persona 5 hasn't evolved at all to fucking Metaphor.
Yeah.
Like, it's pretty much the exact same with just a couple of different things. But it's essentially, it's always just like wind damage, light, medium, heavy, dark damage, light, medium, heavy.
Yeah.
Your health goes up 25%, damage 25%. Like, it's everything is one of those things.
Yeah.
And there's nothing else. Whereas Clair Obscur has AP systems, burn system, like everything kind of synergies with each other and like builds, and like, you know, there's no just clear best thing to do because everything has its uses in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And like Persona games just don't do that and haven't evolved combat wise since there. So like, it borrows a lot, but it elevates in such a great way.
Yeah.
It's definitely its own thing.
It's
now.
Like, it's 100% it's its own thing, and it's like, it's taken a lot of what the best things from a lot of our favorite games, even like RPG games were growing up. Again, like this, even in the ability learning system, feels very Final Fantasy IX.
The Picto system Final Fantasy IX. Yeah. But like in Final Fantasy IX, even the Picto, like those abilities were just like, am I immune to stop, to sleep? Crap. Like, they don't
whereas
mean
in
anything.
This, they're just
whereas
really
in this, they're all useful or do something great to your combat.
So I figure what we should do is the first 10 to 15 minutes of this, maybe 20 minutes of this, we're going to go...
Non-spoilery,
so that anybody listening to the podcast can say whether or not it seems like it's something that they'd want to pick up. After that, we'll go full spoiler mode.
I can do my best, but...
yeah. We'll allow. So I guess there was certain things I wanted to talk about when I look at Clair Obscur's Expedition 33. The first one that kind of blew me away from the trailer and then from my first like 2 or 3 hours playing it, art direction. The world we're in Expedition 33 has and still has piqued my curiosity so much that I haven't played a game like that in a while, where I've been the first 2-3 hours of playing and I'm enjoying everything, but I'm also like, what the fuck is going on?
It kind of reminds you of the end game of every Final Fantasy, doesn't it? The whole world is that final dungeon, you know, where everything is like, gravity makes no sense, water goes upwards, you know,
the world's
things
physics
are just floating for no reason.
Physics,
you know?
Makes no sense. So basically, and this is not spoiled, this would be stuff that would be in the trailer. You start off playing as this character Gustave, and he's going to meet an old flame of his, and unfortunately it's the year of her gommage, and gommage is where
the French word for eraser.
There you are. And it basically, there's a countdown on a monolith way off in the distance from where you're living, and it's counting down from 99 all the way down, and unfortunately this is counting into 33, you know, when you set in to play this game. And anybody who's turned 33 during that year gets gommaged or erased.
Well, at the start of the game it says 34.
Yes. Yeah. And then, so we're witnessing the change over from one year to the next.
That,
And so his love disappears, but he's part of what's known as the Expeditioners, where each year they get volunteers of all age groups, I mean, not children, obviously, but, you know, young enough, to head out to the monolith to try and defeat someone who's known as the Paintress. So she'll stop this countdown, stop the fact that people are dying all the time, and maybe they can go on to live their lives. Mm-hmm. That's how the game starts.
And you don't get any more. You don't even get that information. That's just something you would have figured out, like, from the trailer. But, the game gives you nothing.
Yeah.
And it's very exciting to just talk to people to figure out what kind of world you live in, what are the people like, what are they thinking. And like just farming that like information at the very beginning of the game is a lot of fun because you really just have no clue what's going on.
The world's just, you're walking around you, there's like a really obviously warped Eiffel Tower in the background.
Oh, it looks brilliant the way it's all like
crooked
over to the side. So you can tell that the world has been like shifted by something, like torn apart, everything's kind of fractured,
and that's what I loved about the opening for the game in terms of the mystery, the world,
it was like watching the beginning of a movie and just being like, well, what is this even about, like what's going to happen here, you know, is this are our characters just gonna jump out and be like, let's go on an adventure, something really terrible has happened,
our adventures fucked.
But like, unlike, because the RPG usual mechanic, Darren, is, you know, you wake up in, you know, your family home, your mom and dad are out and like you're having a great time and they tell you to chop wood and then you go up to the mountains to chop wood and then when you come back your whole town has been burned to the ground and you go on your adventure from there. That's like your typical RPG trope. This is absolutely nothing like that. You know absolutely nothing. There's no, you're already just in the middle of this like gommage that's been happening for 67 years.
And it doesn't really follow the classic hero's tale where you are the chosen one. It's like,
you also, you're not a character who's new to it. It's not like you're playing as someone who just arrived at this world.
Yeah, they're all living
the usual. Every single character you play as has spent their whole lives here. So you don't have that kind of perspective of a newcomer to all of this.
So like who you're playing as isn't asking the questions you wish they would. So you could figure things out. You're like, well, of course I'm not going to ask these questions because, they've lived in it.
For not having to tell us the information we want. But it sucks for us because we would desperately love to just ask the playable characters a bunch of questions if we could.
And it's funny because you and me, when I was really keen on playing it, and I think I said it to you to get on board, this is a great game. And the first time we were talking to each other after we played the first couple hours, where the two of us were just like, tell us what the hell is going on. And not in an overly frustrating way that we're not getting fed the information, just in a, for me, just a curiosity, a level of curiosity about the world that I haven't had in a very long time playing a video game. Mm-hmm. So the likes of, I'm trying to think, Persona 5 would have been the most recent one in terms of, I wasn't familiar with the Persona series before I got into that.
But that's why I was curious as well.
But that story's been told, you know, like, I mean, anybody who's been playing Persona games would know kind of how the Persona side of things works. I wasn't. But outside of that, I can't think of a game that I was playing. There was a part of me that was like morbidly interested in what the story of Death Stranding was, but I didn't care enough to play that game to ever figure that out. Do you know that kind of way? And to me, it just still seems like it was too bonkers.
Well, I mean, I got about 40 hours into Death Stranding. I was very near the final boss, and then I watched a 20-minute video explaining the story, and then I said, I'll never play this again. Because it's way more convoluted and stupid than even Metal Gear Solid 4. And like the gameplay and what you're doing is kind of fun, but he just couldn't help himself.
No.
He couldn't help himself being fucking stupid. Like, you know, he'll never make a movie. He says, I want to make a movie. He will never do it because he's shit and he can't write at all. He's just a terrible, terrible writer. Brilliant director. You know, it's a shame he's not at the hands of Metal Gear Delta, because I tell you, Darren, I say it every single week, it's going to be shit.
Yeah. Well, I hope it's just been patched up that it just plays better and looks better and nothing else has been done to it. Then I'd be okay with it. We'll wait and see.
I wouldn't play it for that. Not a chance. Yeah. Like, you're not going to have any of the cool music or any of the cool Kojima stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, wait and see. But in terms of world building, this game does it in a very interesting way. Through the entirety, and we won't get to spoilers just yet, but the entirety, even now, I'm on the epilogue and there's still a lot of stuff that I was like, I wish I knew how this worked, how some of this worked, you know. And at this point, we've been given a couple of, you know, twists, a couple of big story moments, but it still leaves a huge world.
And it is cool that it's not all explained, but you do get, you know, there are these kind of crystals that you pick up, which are left behind by previous expeditions, because, you know, there's been about 50 expeditions before you. Not exactly 67, because as you can see in the charts, that after expedition zero, they actually didn't do any expeditions for 15 years.
Yeah.
And then it starts up again. So yeah. Like, there's been one every year since then. But every now and then you might find a crystal, which kind of leaves like a voice recording of the previous expedition and what they did. And you can kind of tell what kind of adventures they've had. Like, because every one of these could have been a game in itself. Like, every one of these teams have led a different life, have like went through a different set of circumstances to like and try and get to the end.
What I love about this game is kind of, and not in a weird I love things that are grim, but like there's a real hopelessness or helplessness to the what's going on in the world. One of those expeditioners' diaries that you're talking about, I picked up one. It was on an island on the world map, and there was these cool submarine-looking things all wrecked up on the island. And their report is basically, oh, damn it, I can't believe we spent the entire year. You know, our whole plan for this year was to do submarines this time to maybe get further and closer to the Paintress. But we ended up crashing down on this thing. All of the submarines are doomed, and we're all just going to starve on this island. And that was an expedition.
Yeah.
I'm like, fuck, could you imagine planning for that for a year and that's how it goes? But everything like that it's such a challenging world to live in, that every expedition that's gone before you has come a cropper for a multitude of horrible reasons.
And there have been a multitude of reasons. And some aren't terrible, and some even found solace kind of at the end, you know? Like they've all led very, very different lives and had completely different expeditions. And some at the end were like almost accepting their fate. And like, there is very much that element of passing on what you've learned along the way for the ones to come after.
Yeah.
Like, for the first 20 hours
is,
of the game.
What is Gustav's, or what is the expeditioner's quote? For those who come after?
I mean, it's a great line, and it makes sense, because at first I had no idea. Do you know when you're running around and you see this little circle thing while you're playing the game, and when you press square at that, you teleport to it. For the first 20 hours, I had no idea what that was or why it was doing that. But then, like, I came across a bunch of expeditioners who were like the building crew.
Yeah.
And like, they were Expedition 67. And what they were doing specifically was going around trying to make it easier for other expeditions to get a foothold in some of these areas. So they were building these like handholds for the mountains and things like that. And part of it was building those little circular things that you could teleport to. And beside their corpses were a bunch of those teleport things. And I was like, oh my God, they were the ones bringing these around the map that I could teleport to a place quicker. I had no idea what the hell that those things were. And that realization was really cool, that like, I'm being helped along the way by all those people who died ahead of me.
Trying to get there, yeah.
In many different ways, small or big, but it's all there. Like, you are, there's hope in that, like, there's a guiding hand.
There's always progression, you know.
As dark as the game may seem at times, because it seems like there's no hope, there are the people who came before, gave their lives just to give you even the smallest bit of boost. If it's just a handrail on a fucking, on a little cliff.
To get that little bit closer to the Paintress. And
it's just, it adds more to it, because there's far more depth to it. There's like, you really need to do this, because you're running out of time. There's not going to be.
Which is the interesting thing, because by the time we get to your Expedition 33, even when you're running around the map, there's no people who are old at all. Because everybody who's older than 33 has already perished.
So by the time you get to like Expedition 20, nobody will be old enough to ever really do this again.
Yeah.
You know, and it'd be at that point, like, I think it reached the stage in the game by 33. If you talk to people, like even your love interest, she doesn't want to have kids, because she's like, why would I have a kid if that kid could only live to be like 12 or 13 years old before it dies? So now it's reached a stage where the idea of even having a kid is a bad idea, because you're just sending them to their doom.
Yeah,
you know?
or not necessarily, like, maybe your kid could be around when they figure out or defeat the Paintress, but the problem is that the parents will never be able, they won't be able to spend time, because they will either just, well, they should probably be volunteering for the expedition because it's the only way to save everybody, or they're close to being gommaged. So if you have a kid, you might get 3 or 4 years with the kid before either you gommage or you go on an expedition. So there's this real kind of like,
well, humanity
pressure
is winding down.
Yeah.
Like, this is Expedition 33. There'll be maybe 3 or 4 that come after you, but that's it. Then humanity's lost, you know?
Yeah.
And there's that real sense of dread that, like, guys, we have to get this right. We can't.
Yeah.
And, like, it just adds so much to the world and the stakes. Before you've even played the game, before you've even gone anywhere or done anything, that plot, that kind of crazy what-if scenario, like, it's just so well thought out and like implemented in a really good way. Like I said, we don't play as a character who's asking a bunch of stupid questions and everyone's like, what, you don't know what the Gamage is? Like everyone knows what that is, so that the slow trickle of information you do get like feels really cool and well earned, like, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. We won't go any more in the story just yet. Well, I think, you know, just in terms of that's the basic kind of introduction to the
game. That's all in the first hour.
Yeah,
you know?
yeah, exactly. That all those feelings
and
everything.
You could analyze the first couple of hours for an eternity. You could write fucking
so much lore about what's going on.
About what that is and what's going on.
So from a narrative perspective, art direction, love it. Next thing I want to get down to is the game looks amazingly gorgeous as well. I mean, art direction in terms of where they were going with the story, but also graphically,
but
the game is...
But everyone kept telling me, like, oh, this is a very small studio, so it's not going to look good. But I'm like...
Looks better than a lot of games.
It looks
better
than most games I've ever played. And maybe it's because it's just a backdrop a lot of the time, so you're just kind of running along these kind of...
But the lighting in the game is superior to so many things I've played right now. Like,
I don't
know
how they... Is it just because it's Unreal 5 and people have finally figured that out?
Maybe. I wonder. Or because, like that, and I think it's one of those things that we take for granted maybe in AAA games that go through development hell. And like this Sandfall Interactive, the team behind it, it strikes me that they had a vision right from the get-go, knew exactly what they were doing, and never diverted from that. They were like, this is the game we want to create, and we're going to create it. And I think they were able to kind of hyper-focus on, like that, like making the thing look beautiful because they had a full vision, as opposed to a game going through a development cycle of years and years and changing over hands. These people knew what they wanted to do, you know?
It's so hard to even think that because, like, the story is excellent. So I'd be like, oh, this is a great writer. But the combat is excellent. So it's a guy who understood game mechanics and had a great idea for elevating RPGs. This is the greatest turn-based RPG since Persona 5. Is now, I would say, the benchmark of how to do a turn-based RPG forever going forward. Like,
well, you know? On that, I'll take that as a good segue. We'll go on to the next part, combat. The you know, and again, we won't go too heavy spoilery things just yet, but from a base level, for those who haven't played it and are listening to this and think they might, it's a turn-based RPG in all its classic fashions, but it's implemented two very engaging ways for you to never really step away from that constant turn-based battle. Okay. One is a parry or a dodge. So when an enemy attacks you, they're very much... it's a time-based, turn-based combat game, so you really have to pay attention to the attacks and how they move of all the enemies to either parry or dodge their attacks. And the game also is, when you're using skills or attacking, it will give you prompts to press. I think it's
that
just the X
button. That one I like a lot less, especially because they're so easy to do that, like, you would never really miss any of those. Like, it's pretty much just press X twice at the right
moment. And they're just a bit distracting.
And because, like, I don't know when they're going to pop up. I'm constantly looking out for it. And the animations of my attack look so brilliant.
Yeah.
But I can't focus on that because I'm waiting for the X to pop up on the screen to press it. So sometimes I'm like, the animations in this combat are beautiful, but
why the
I'm
fuck
missing
am I,
it.
Yeah, why
sometimes
the fuck am I,
I just want to
X?
Not press X at all just so I can sit back and enjoy the actual attack being given.
So it's introduced those two things, which are simple in theory, but when executed as well as this game has done, it has made the combat so enjoyable. And your characters have their standard attack. They have, like, your standard RPG skills, but in this one they're very much individual to the person, as opposed to like a magic system that everyone shares. Or
it has
like
an
that.
AP system instead of MP. They have AP, where you start off with maybe 3 or 4, and by attacking you get one, and by parrying you get one, and like then certain moves might grant you some to your allies and things like that. So like a really powerful attack would cost, say, 7 AP, and a really weak attack would cost 2 AP. So it makes sense to keep a weak attack and a strong attack, because, you know, there's different AP costs, and like, it's not like MP where you have a pool of 100. This slowly builds each turn, you know.
Yeah,
so like, you have to start with weaker moves and gradually build to your stronger ones, and how you do that is the key to combat in this, like, and how to maximize your AP and build it without using too much, and to give it to other characters as well. It's not like I can cast Ultima right out the gate and then just keep spamming. Like, in pretty much every RPG that there is, you'll just use the same thing over and over again because it's successful. And this, you really, and I always feel like, oh man, I don't have enough move slots. I wish I had more, because like, there's so many moves and they do so many different things that I really want to use more of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that some of them look so cool, some of them are so individual. So the character that you really develop bonds with the characters in terms of, you know, Lune is your kind of your magic user. She's quite cool. She floats around the place and she's got the, like a weird looking kind of weapon. She holds on to these things called stains that when she uses some of her magic, her weapon captures these stains, which can be combined with other magic to make them more powerful. Or even you can like throw them all into one skill move called like Mayhem, where she blasts all those elements at the enemy. So, and that's just one character. Yes. That's just one character's kind of, what would you say, gameplay loop almost. Yeah. But each character has their individual.
She could even be played as a healer or yeah. like a specific irk damage dealer or like lightning or whatever. Like even last night, like I have my setup for Lune, which is, like you said, using that Mayhem ability because I just think it's OP as hell. But then I was just thinking to myself, you know what? I never use Earth element. I want to see what that looks like. And her Earth attack, she just like scooped up rocks from the ground and fired them at the end. Just like Toph did in Avatar.
Her movements are real airbender as well.
She has
yeah.
bare feet. It looked like she was an airbender firing all these like things. And I was like, oh man, an Avatar game should be done just like this.
You know, yeah.
That's how Toph should attack. That's how Lune attacks. And it looks amazing. And now I have a bunch of Earth attacks on her moveset just for now so that I can just watch what they do. You know, because it's so visually pleasing to like watch some of these attacks.
And she's a great character. We won't go into too much into it right now, but she's one of the earlier characters that you're introduced to and that's on your team. And just quite interesting. She's kind of the real like brains.
She's the black and white mage.
Yeah, and the brains behind the operation. Brains, yeah, someone who's like developed.
She's the scholar. You know?
Yeah.
She knows a lot about everything.
And she's the one who's like, well, I think this is the best way for Expedition 33 to you know, do their job. So she's a cool character, magic based again, loads of different ways to use that. For ages at the beginning of the game I used her as a healer and that was great in itself, but she's got so many great abilities in there after that. Now I'm just kind of, you know, just she's my strongest character now at this stage. You go on to a character like Mael, who you're introduced to right from the get-go with the character you play as called Gustav. And Mael is kind of like a fencer almost. She's a sword, and her certain ones of her skills move her into different stances. Different stances mean different things, and you can kind of combo the stances onto each other. Certain character effects or enemies, if they're like burnt or something like that, some of her attacks against burnt characters or defenseless characters, anything like that, will change her stance or make her moves more powerful. Mm-hmm. So she's a real cool one to play as well. Like again, her moves look, her the animation of all of her stuff looks amazing as well.
She just kind of floats through the air like she's like a ballerina with a sword.
Yes.
Like it looks fantastic how elegant she is and how like acrobatic she is with the blade. Mm-hmm. And so it's an absolute treat to watch Lune or Mael's attacks.
Yeah.
But my character is Verso. Like he is my boy. And like just because I came up to the final boss and I'd learned, well not the final boss, this the big bad, and I learned just a brand new attack before I fought the boss, so that when I went in, I was using it for the very first time, and I was just captivated. I was like, oh my god, I have you. You are nothing. You know, that type of, like, where the boss thinks that they're the shit, but I'm like, no, I learned this.
look what move I just learned, you're going down. Yeah,
you have no chance against
me. And Verso's kind of like, I quite like Verso. His stuff is based on getting his rank up
So his kind of skill and power builds over time.
Yeah.
So I have, like, pretty much with everyone, because you need the AP to unleash bigger attacks, you need to slowly build. But with Verso, he literally is doing that. Like, he has a rank D, C, B, A, and to S. And I think it was only yesterday, the day before, the first time I ever got to S, because none of my moves required me to be an S. You know, I was just like, I have loads of C rank moves and B rank moves, and I was just using them all willy-nilly, you know? And then I just getting better at dodging and then get bettering at building the rank. And then I was like, oh, you know, maybe I'll unlock a couple of these S rank abilities, see what they do. And boy, do they change the game. Like, if you were good enough to just dodge and not get hit, you were rewarded massively for it. Like,
and he even has, and we'll get on to Pictos in terms of the abilities and the skills the characters use now in a second, but one of the Pictos you can use is that your character becomes more and more powerful until they are hit.
Yes.
And I used to have that on Verso. And I was telling you before, rather than learn how to dodge, which has a greater window to use, I straight away from the game was only using parry, so that
the
I was
opposite
just
me. Yeah, I only start using parry recently, and but the reason is because I only taught if you parried you got one AP once per turn. I did not realize you could parry three hits and get
three AP.
I didn't realize that until like 2 or 3 days ago, and I was
really?
Oh my god, I've been missing out on so
much
AP.
Because like with certain characters, especially even at the start of the game, there's certain enemies that will come at you and they'll have like 3 or 4 moves in a row, and if you can parry each one of those, you get a cool looking counter attack, which is very powerful, and B, an AP for each one of those parries. Yep. So by the time it comes around to your actual move, You're locked and loaded, ready to go.
Ready to go and hit them with a big yeah. attack. Yeah. So I very rarely got big attacks from my like first 50 hours of the game.
Yeah. We got one of the other characters we haven't really spoken about, Gustav, who you start the game with. They introduce an interesting mechanic as well for this turn-based game that all of your characters have, which is called a free hit, where you hold L2 and you can aim to shoot at the characters. And certain enemies will be holding something or part of their design. You can spot a weakness, and if you can shoot it,
yeah,
it causes
like some sort of glowing orb or something. Yeah.
Some have a lantern. If you blow up the lantern with a free shot, it's double damage.
There's one little floating guy that's just holding up a mine, and it's just so obvious. If you shoot that, it'll blow up. So at the start of the game treats it quite easy. They're literally like kind of showboating.
Look at this bomb. You want to shoot this bomb? Yeah, I'm telling you.
You're like, what happens if I shoot that? And like, everyone dies. You're like, oh, brilliant.
So that doesn't take up your turn, but it does take up AP. So you can kind of combine that with your skills and your normal attack. Attack with each character to kind of do extra damage.
That's a very cool system as well, because a lot of fights I'll go in and just fire off my gun and not even start my turn and everyone's dead.
There's a great move that Verso has, and I believe it's like for all the damage that's done that turn by free hits will make this attack more powerful. And I remember there was one time where he was on like maybe A rank or something like that, and I got Lune to fall. Like, we had like this point two or three characters had 7 AP before him. I just got them to free hit the shit out of the enemy and then got Versa to go into attack, and it was so strong. And at that point I couldn't break 9999 damage, but if I could have, it would have been amazing. Characters, and that, you know, that's the kind of the skills and how the characters are different, but kind of briefly on the characters without going too far, and I won't spoil other characters that come into the game just yet, but I love the characters. I love, at the beginning, there's less of a them getting to know each other, but as the game goes on.
You were dead right when you told me that would open up a bit more. Because
yes.
My biggest criticism when we spoke about this a couple of weeks ago was that the characters, they're just not talking to each other enough.
Yeah.
They're only really focused on what they need to do and where they need to go.
Yeah.
So they're not having one-on-one dialogue. They're not really chilling out.
Yeah.
But it was only immediately after that point in the game where I was that they actually introduce a part of the game where you can
a relationship builder, like,
yeah,
essentially.
Relationship building kind of thing, where at night if you sit by the campfire you can talk to each of the characters and build relations with them. And like, that is the one component that was missing, and they do introduce it. It just takes to the end of act one before they do.
Yeah.
But once they do, you really start to learn more about the characters,
which is great,
in a great way.
Yeah.
And they are very interesting, you know.
We'll move on now, Craig, to the kind of each character, you have like a skill tree for their own individual skills, but then there is, and that's kind of standard, you build up skill points, you use them to unlock. The further you get to the tree, the more points it takes to unlock.
Of course.
It's okay. I don't think visually the skill tree looks amazing in that game. I think that could have done with maybe,
I don't care what the skill tree looks like. You know?
Well, yeah, I think for me, I was just looking at it being like, there's nothing really for me to enjoy here. Would have been one of my complaints that I would have, I mean, like, you know, like the sphere grid from Final Fantasy X. There's things that are satisfying to unlock. I didn't feel like it was satisfying to unlock new abilities.
Well, if you're going with a complaint on that system, for me, it would be more though, and we're going to talk about Pictos, but, and I love Pictos for the passives, but I hate Pictos for the fact that they also have stat buffs on them and you can only equip 3. Mm-hmm. And like, for me, the Pictos should have been their own thing with no buffs, and you should just have had armor, like in a traditional sense.
Just upgrade.
Sometimes you're equipping a Picto and you're just like, I want one because it has a cool ability, but it's only giving me 100 health.
Yeah.
Whereas you'll have a Picto that is useless but gives you 1,000 health, and I'm like, ah, come on, I just want the cooler ability, like, let me have that.
Yeah, you know? And that's the thing with Pictos. So how they work in the game is that you kind of pick them up throughout the world,
and there's hundreds of them, and they're brilliant, and they are game changing, each one.
Yeah. And you have to equip them to a character. Only one character can equip them when you first have them, and after, I think it's four fights. It becomes unlocked and an ability that anybody can learn. So you've 3 slots to pick Pictos. Anybody who has a Pictos in that slot, no other party can have that Pictos equipped directly to them.
But that's only, you get that ability and you get the buffs associated with it.
Yes.
But the buffs aren't, like, I would remove the buffs entirely.
Yes.
I don't like that they're attached in that way. You basically want the ability, and with the ability you can have way more than 3, so you can equip 3 and they give you the buffs.
Yes.
But if you have these things called Lumina points,
yeah,
and every character maybe you start off with like 30, and like different abilities cost a different amount of points, usually based on how strong they are.
And these abilities are, by the way, the Pictos that you've learned. So once you've learned a Pictos, it becomes an ability that can be selected with your Lumina points.
Exactly.
Which took me a little bit to figure out when I first started playing the game.
Especially to start the game, because you only have a few. So yeah. And pretty much every one of them was already equipped to a character, so you can't really figure out that they're passive. Yeah. You know? But they are there to be passively, and you can increase your amount of Lumina points gradually over time. Like yeah. pretty much in every dungeon, you'll pick up a point here and there. Yeah. And it'll always be, I always love getting them because I'm always like, oh, brilliant. I can
make my
character that little bit stronger now. Yeah. Because yeah. there's, like I said, there's hundreds of Pictos and they're all so wildly different.
Yeah.
Like one might be you'll do an extra 50% damage if your health is 10% or less.
Yeah.
So then you could, like with a few more like that, you could build a build where like you're ridiculously powerful in the game, but if you get hit once, you're always gonna die, you know?
And there is another pick though called Glass Cannon, which means that you're 25% more powerful, but damage against you is 25% more powerful as well. Right. So there's all these kind of, I mean, one of the builds that I got for my character Mael at one point was she has an ability to cast Shell on the team. And the three kind of main Pictos that I gave her was that when she casts Shell, it lasts for 2 turns longer. Uh-huh. When she casts it, it's 10% more effective.
Oh, you got that one too.
Yeah, nice. And when she casts it, she also casts Powerful. So anytime I got Mael to cast Shell on the party, it was a massive buff for
everyone.
Yeah. Which was cool. And that's the way you can kind of design. So she almost became like... She's got a big support character for me, yeah. And I think
just through one Pictos, you know, one or two, and just hundreds of these things. So like, you can really just pick out 3 or 4 of these Pictos and like drastically change your build around it. Mm-hmm. And we haven't even talked about the weapons, but like the weapons, just like the Pictos, drastically change how you play as well.
Big time.
Like, you know, there are weapons that'll just make you take twice as much damage, but like you do a bunch of like elemental or burn damage as a result, or it'll just make you play in a certain way. Like if you're CL, like some of her spells, like they cast this thing called Foretell, and if you consume some of that Foretell, you might gain health, which would buff your entire team.
Yeah.
And there's like weapons that she gets that like doubles that or make you not get it at all. And like even with Verso, there's like, we said he had to go from rank D up to S. Like some of his weapons will start you in rank C or start you in rank B, and like just scrolling between 2 or 3 different weapons, the variance between them is insane.
Huge.
To the point where you'd be like, okay, I have to change all my Pictos. All 20 of my Pictos need to be changed to suit this weapon. Yeah. And I can really change who I play.
Last night was the first time I picked it up, and I was on holidays for a week. And it was the first time I picked it up in a week. And the first thing that I did, and I spent like 2.5 hours doing it, was resetting all my characters to be like, well, how do I want my L to play? How do I want... And it was so cool. I had like Luna was this character now that her weapon was fire damage is 20% more effective, and all your fire elemental abilities are 2 AP cheaper, and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, oh fuck, she's just like this fire monster type thing.
So if you just think to yourself fire, and then just go into all your Pictos and all your weapons,
fire,
and like if you just lean into fire with the character, there's a lot you can do just with that. Like alone.
And the variance is, as you said, it's there's so much. And like I even watched a video, some guy who's at the very end of the game and he's fighting the super difficult end game monsters, or Nevrons as they're called, the enemies that are in this world. And I just watched him, and he just got the gun out, and it was almost like a machine gun. Uh-huh. Like part of what he was shooting was just giving him more AP points. So it was this constant barrage, like a Gatling gun that he had.
Where I am now, sometimes I will shoot, and like if I shoot the enemy 5 times, I might end up having more AP than when I started.
Yes.
Like that happens so many times because there's so many ways of getting back AP.
Yeah.
Like
if you hit a weakness,
hitting a marked target, hitting, inflicting a status effect for the first time, inflicting, shooting an enemy that's already burned. Like these type of things will grant you more AP if you have those Pictos. So sometimes you could just shoot someone like 20 times.
Yeah, just keep going.
And they'll just die. Yeah. Like, and you haven't even started your turn yet. And you're like, wow, look what I'm after doing just by manipulating all this. Like, to the point where they've definitely made the game breakable.
Yes.
If you like equip the right amount of Pictos, you could be an absolute god.
And I loved the fact that when At the point I am in the game, minor spoiler here for a Pictos that you can receive. At the point of the game that we're at, you get a Pictos that you can learn that allows you to break 9999 damage.
Yeah.
And the moment I saw that, I realized there was a huge amount of endgame. It kind of reminded me very much of Final Fantasy X, where you're at the end of the game, but you can fight all the Dark Aeons, mm-hmm. and you can get everybody to spread out on the sphere grid, all that kind of stuff. I was like, oh shit, it's got those vibes. Like, there's a lot of endgame for me to play here.
It definitely has all that stuff. I was delighted when I did the dungeon yesterday, and like 2 hours in, I was like, oh my God, I'm still here.
Yeah.
It was like very much like a dungeon from the main game.
Yeah.
And the characters were even talking to each other every time I went into a new screen. And even when I got to the boss, there was a big massive lengthy conversation. I was like, this is still main story. It's just optional, you know?
Crazy. So crazy. Before we go into our spoilers, we'll talk about like the story and what we love about the game now when we're each like, what, 40, 50 hours in, whatever it might be. Do you recommend Clair Obscur's Expedition 33, Craig?
I would recommend it to everyone. I think it has something for everyone. Even if you're not a fan of turn-based combat, I think you could definitely get something out of just pressing dodge at the right moment and then just hitting it. Because, well, I will say, the game definitely caters to people who don't really know how to work the combat. Because if you just, and like you were saying, you were parrying stuff right from the get-go, I was just doing a dodge. But if all of your characters, if you just get good at pressing R1 as the enemy hits you, that's enough by itself to win the game.
Like, yes.
You know, because the counterattacks in the game
so powerful.
Are overpowered completely. Like, the game wants you, if you're struggling in any way, to just use counter for everything. If all you did was hit R1, you would eventually win the fight. Because it does way more damage than your actual attacks.
Yeah. So
especially
beneficial.
Now that I have the break 9999 damage limit as well. The first time I did the counterattack, I went, oh my God, like, that did 5 times more damage than any of my other attacks like combined. And I was like, okay, the game really, it's basically like enemy is going to hit you, but just as it goes to hit you, press R1 and you'll be fine.
Yeah.
And I think anyone could be good at that. You know, you don't have to be like reading all this type of stuff or learning this, learning that. It's just R1 when prompted, you know?
Yeah.
And you're not necessarily prompted, but it comes up on the screen. But the story is really great. Visually, it's really great. We didn't talk about the music. The music is fantastic.
Sorry, the music is unbelievable, actually. Yeah, I spent a little bit of time when I was resetting all my characters on the menus. Anytime a song kind of went and finished at your camp, you've got like a...
There's a music box,
and you unlock tracks to play through the game. I went and actually explored the music a bit last night, because like I said, I spent 2 hours easily just resetting all my characters, going through all the stats and everything, just going and changing
That's
the music.
That's one of my favorite things to do in the game, just resetting
it's
my
so
stats.
So satisfying,
and like equipping things. Yeah. I'm like, oh man, this really caters to my RPG blood.
From my own perspective, I highly recommend this, as Craig said, to anybody. To anybody, be it a lover of the JRPG or RPG franchise, turn-based combat lovers will fucking go mad for this. Like, I've been craving a good turn-based game. We talked about how Star Ocean was meant to be, oh, look at this thing, and there's just so little depth or soul to the likes of a Star Ocean.
Sea of Stars.
Yeah.
Like, if you played Sea of Stars for 2 hours and then played this for 2 hours,
you'd be like, the fucking
you would give Sea of Stars like a 4 out of 10 at best.
Yeah.
Like, and yet IGN and all those other places, they have it like an 8 or 9 or like excellent, very
and it just
good.
Gets very boring very quick, whereas this game, throughout the game, it's constantly introducing new things,
but the combat is just so visually pleasing that like it's just
it feels
a
good.
Joy
it
to get
feels,
into a fight.
Yeah, it feels
know?
Good.
You don't. It doesn't feel like, oh, here we go. Like, you're having fun. You're learning new things or implementing new skills or just watching the awesome attacks. Like, sometimes if you dodge 3 hits in a row, sometimes you feel like a badass. Like, you know.
Yeah.
And the more you fight enemies, the more likely you are to remember how their attacks went. So, like, the first couple of times you might get wrecked, you might get killed, but there's no real. Like, if you get, it just loads back up again, and you're like two seconds away from where you don't lose like progress, you know?
Yeah.
The idea is you lose a lot in the order of getting good. And when you get, like, if you get annihilated by an enemy the first time, but the second time you manage to parry those attacks, the feeling, the just absolute pure bliss.
You know, Chris will be listening to this episode and he'd be like, would you guys just fucking play a Souls game already in terms of like
but
that
the
going
Souls
back?
Because what I don't like is those Souls games are just you know, you running around reading a couple of books to find out the lore. With these, I have a team of like, you know, how many other, I'm not going to say, but there's a team of us and we're talking to each other and there's cutscenes and we're like, it's not just exposition by this fucking scary ass looking monster that like doesn't actually talk, but when I kill him, he'll leave a little orb which will have some writing in it or something. You know, I don't care for that. I want a good cinematic story.
Yes,
you know,
this one has.
I want to be, after an hour of playing, I want to be able to put my controller down and just like watch it for a while.
Soak
you
it
know?
In.
I just want that, you know. That's why I really used to enjoy the early Metal Gear games, because, you know, you get through an area and be like, all right, cool, now I can just sit back and enjoy the cutscene for a while. It's kind of like this, I'm playing a game, but I'm also watching a movie slash show type thing. And you very much feel that with Clair Obscur.
And a final point on that before we'll move on to our spoilers. The game came out at £50. You know, like £30 cheaper than your standard AAA price for a game now. And that alone is enough for me to say, you know, if you're nervous about paying AAA prices, fucking invest in these guys. Invest in a games company that's willing to make a game of this quality at that price. And just,
it's just such, for what you're getting at that price is absolutely insane.
My only critique is that I don't like some of the UI.
The UI isn't great. Like, it's hard. You get used to it, but the UI isn't great in that you don't really know. Like, especially because I like to equip Pictos. Those are those things based on the Lumina amount they cost. So the ones you equip to yourself, i.e. those three that you could do.
Have them as the higher cost ones.
I always try and make them the highest costing ones I can. But there's no way to see how much it costs when you're equipping it. You have to exit out and go back and pick those. I hate that. Yeah. That really, really bothers me. But again, this is a €50 game. So I just pushed that aside. You know, if they had charged me €80, that would have been maybe 0.5% off the review score. But in this, I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
You know, you it's like an extra £30 if I want that. No, that's fine. You can keep that out if
I can still pay £50 for this, you know?
Because that is just such a small price. I expected way more glaring issues or problems or visual
bugs and everything
for a £50 game. I was like, the reason they're doing this is maybe they think the game isn't long enough or isn't looking good enough. But I mean, it plays better, it looks better, it sounds better than most AAA games that there are. You know? So I don't know why they even charged the £50. They could have easily charged the 80, and I'd gladly have paid it. But because they've charged the 50, they're getting a better review score. It's just the way it is.
I'll put a warning now for all those listening. That is our non-spoiler review or recommendation for our listeners who haven't played the game. If you haven't played the game but don't care about spoilers, please listen on. But at this point onwards, we are talking spoilers. Yeah. So log off now.
So just stop the episode unless you've played, because
unless you're weird and you just want to hear it's getting like,
no, just don't. I'll sacrifice everyone listening if that's what it takes. Like, you know, just it's just too good to
get have ruined. Going into spoilers now, Craig, or spoiler world. We are at the end of the game. Essentially, we just have kind of one battle left where we are. Yeah. We've gotten to a point where we have defeated the Paintress, which is the, you know, what you think is the goal of the game, but there's a
it's like in Final Fantasy X when you've just defeated Unalaska. We're like at that point, mm-hmm. We have the airship, if you want to call it that, and now we just can basically go anywhere we want in the world and kind of finish up some kind of like side quests and side content before going off and doing the final battle. But the final battle is there should we want it.
Yeah.
And there's all sorts of crazy stuff that we could do as well. And that's the because as soon as we reached this point, they gave us that Picto to break the 9999 damage.
Oh, I knew I was in for a treat then, yeah.
And you know it. Just like in Final Fantasy X, where your weapons can learn to break it, like your power scaling just goes off the rails from this point on, where you can really, they really want you to be like, how much damage can you do? Can you get to 1 million? Can you get to 2 million?
Yeah,
you
know,
And there's probably people like, I can hit 5 million. You
know? Just all the combinations. Up to this point now, I think there was kind of two big major twists in the game, narratively, that the first one I loved, the second one I need to finish the game to see how I fully feel about that one. The first one though was the death of Gustav, who I kind of assumed was the main character. You mean he's the character you start off as. Yeah. I will always applaud a game or a story that has no fear in knocking off the main character, who you assume to be the main character, because based off the world that they live in, it is very easy for anybody to be killed at any time. And I think they really hit that home with the fact that you're just running around having a nice chat with Mael at camp, and all of a sudden Gustav gets the fucking a massive hole put in him trying to save Mael. And I was watching that scene going like, holy fuck, I can't believe they've done this, you know?
But, and I did really enjoy it, and I thought narrative, like, it was really, really cool and exciting. But the second someone else showed up, I just naturally assumed it was Gustav from the future or from a different dimension.
Yes.
So I was robbed of the emotional kind of stakes of it.
We didn't get
it wasn't until about 2-3 hours later did I realize he was in fact dead. You know? I was just like, no, he'll be back. You know, like RPGs don't do this, and for good reason, because then all their like abilities and stats that you've accumulated won't go anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, but that was a really good. Again, I think as well, setting up the game, I didn't want to say this at the start of the episode, but when you arrive at the start of your expedition, and there's meant to be, I don't know, is there like 40 people on this expedition
something
with
like
you?
That, yeah.
And you arrive, and this character, Renoir, who's an old guy.
Just some old man.
Yeah, and he's just some old dude, and just fucking wipes the floor with everyone.
Starts killing people, and then very similar to say Berserk with the Eclipse, all sorts of like the Nevron show up, and they are like, they're not just ordinary Nevron, these are the like biggest, baddest of the Nevron, because I've actually gone back to that area where your ships touch down, and even now I can't beat those guys, like
really
they are. So I liked, because it kind of can feel weird how like you arrive on a beach and like you lose like 30 plus members and then you can go 100 hours without losing anyone else, you know? But in this, like, they were actually that area, or maybe Renoir summoned them, but like that beach is full of the worst, most strongest Nevron that there are. Mm-hmm. You know, those ones with the kind of hands over their face.
Yeah, and the cutscenes
like,
and everything.
I cannot beat them. They are ridiculously powerful. So I like that continuity in terms of like, oh no, they weren't
this,
just
this
little
was
pussies.
This was a bad place to land.
This was a very bad place to land, and they were very unlucky, and other expeditioners didn't land here and landed in other places and didn't face this kind of immediate annihilation that Expedition 33 face.
And kind of story wise we've had a major twist kind of just literally at the point that we got to. We had a major twist in the story arrive just before you go into kind of fight the Paintress, or just after you fight the Paintress, and that is that. And I don't know how I feel about this one. I need to finish the game to see how I feel about this one.
Yes.
But it's basically,
I'm not sure of her exact power, because she didn't immediately bring Gustav back to life.
Mael, yes, who is now known as the Painter. So if anyone who's finished the game or knows towards the end of the game that we're at, we are all trapped in a canvas.
A painting.
Yes. We are all, this is just, it's a, you know, they woke up and it was all a dream, which I never love as a story plot. But on this one, I'm still curious as to where it might go. But what it did show me, so it basically there are in the real world groups known as painters and groups known as writers who seem to be at loggerheads with each other. And we know nothing else about the main world apart from that. And the painters and writers seem to have some sort of supernatural abilities. In the case of painters, they painted this canvas that's come to life. And basically, your character, Verso, who comes in after Gustav dies...
Immediately after.
Yeah.
Too soon. It should have been 2 hours later.
Yeah. He causes a fire in the house in the real world that kills him, and his mother, in her grief, spends a huge amount of time creating...
Well, I think Mael started the fire, and he saved her.
And died.
And she was just left horribly burned.
Right. And then in the grief of all of that, the mother just kind of goes into Verso's painting and just kind of takes control of it and recreates Verso and lots of other characters. And basically, everyone in that world is a creation of Verso's mother. And the gommage is Renoir, her husband, trying to stop her, because what she's doing is just creating all these people that don't really exist, and it's probably not good for her health and probably not good for them in terms of, you know,
she's just grieving, and he's coming, Renoir's coming in, and he's trying to basically bring her out of this world by shutting it down.
Yeah,
so he's using his power to try and destroy the painting.
Yes.
And she's using the last of her power, which is counting down from 99. It's kind of like, this is all she can. This is as much time as you can have to stay in that world.
Yes, because she can't hold off Renoir, who is systematically taking people out of... Yeah. So the
gommage... So he destroys... Oh, no, sorry, he's not doing that. Yeah, sorry, continue.
The gommage is essentially Renoir taking that group or that age group of people out of the painting, like just deleting them from the painting because it's not good for his wife to be suffering this grief. And although I don't like the whole, we woke up and it was all a dream, or this is a fake world, I do really love the idea that this has all been made through someone's grief. I find that quite interesting.
I do enjoy that. Yeah. That's what someone might do, like just to keep hold of their loved ones.
Yeah.
We would do anything. So like when you have that as the emotional reasoning, you can kind of, well, it's hard to argue that someone might do something crazy to be able to see their loved ones again.
And once that twist comes in, all of our characters now know that they're not exactly real.
The only, when I thought about this last night, Darren, I just thought, do you know that there's only, in the entire game, there's only three real characters in the whole thing, you know.
That is Renoir, Maya.
No, Renoir's not real. He's fake too. There is Mael, there's the Paintress, and there's the Curator, who is Renoir.
Yeah.
Renoir is also just a figment of like that's, she's the version of him that has been created.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And same with Verso, he's not real, and Renoir isn't real, and Alicia isn't real.
Yeah.
You know, even Mael is her, but the real version of her.
She got her memories back when they defeated the Paintress.
It was all pretty cool, but you know, it's hard to really kind of cipher without having completed it for real. But it was a very interesting explanation and means of showcasing what this all was.
What I thought was really cool was when we defeated the Paintress, you got that deadly cutscene where everyone arrives back in Lumiere.
Oh, and it's all the music of the victory. So good.
And everyone's like, hey, we've done it. We've done it. This
in many
amazing.
Ways, that could have been the end of the game. They could have just ended it there.
I thought it was. Because I was rushing. Not rushing, but I had one or two nights left to play it before I went to my holidays. And I knew this was the episode we were doing when I got back. And I was like, well, I need to finish it. And I was watching this cutscene, leaning back, being like, great job, Darren. You finally did it. And then everyone in this cutscene, everyone you think you've saved, because you've killed the Paintress, there's nothing stopping Renoir's ability to kind of just destroy the characters in it. And everyone just gets gamaged.
Yeah,
everyone you thought you saved just gets gamaged. And I was sitting there watching going like, holy shit. And I loved that, but wasn't so keen on the idea that it was like, oh, you were never real to begin with type thing. I thought it was just like, oh, you fuck shit up. Mm-hmm. But that was a great moment. But then I was like, shit, I haven't finished the game because you arrived.
That's what happened.
Yeah.
A part of me was just like, because then immediately after, it's just Moel and Verso again. And I'm like, does that mean it's just us? Like, are my characters just gone? A part of me was like, it would have been really cool if they were.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Because you would have had those two and Monoko because he wasn't affected by the gamage.
Yeah, so
it would
just be those three left.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my God, two of my favorite characters just removed again. But no, she kind of realizes that she's also a Paintress, just like everyone else in the family. And she can use her power within the painting. And she brings Ciel
and Luna back.
But she also brings back a bunch of other people. Now, I haven't gone back to Lumiere, but it looked like she actually brought a bunch of them back to life.
But not, it didn't, so in the cutscene, because you get like a montage of her going to all the places you visit and taking the chroma to do something with it. And then you got this cutscene at the end where it's them standing on a ledge looking out at the world map, essentially, and all of these people walking behind her. But I don't know if they were truly living. That's my thing. So I don't know if she can actually...
Oh, because she was able to bring Ciel back and Luna, I'm like, she can definitely bring them back.
So she was able to, in the scene where Luna and Ciel get gamaged, she, in her unknown ability, seems to save part of their soul in that moment that they're getting destroyed, which is why she's able to bring them back directly to life. And I don't know if this is just a big plot tool, essentially,
I taught that too, Darren, just before you go, because Ciel is convinced, because I did her final
companion mission
chapter with her yesterday, but she now, because her and Verso had built up a bit of a relationship, she's like, no, just so you know, I'll be getting my husband back, and Miel is going to bring him back, so, you know, I will see him again, and everyone's going to be fine. So Ciel very much thinks that Miel can do this, you know, so I assume then, because we weren't really seeing what was happening with Mael, I think CL did see that. And she can see that, Mael has the power to bring back the people who've been gamaged.
Mm.
But her husband wasn't gamaged. He drowned. You know? So does that mean then that Mael can bring anyone back in any form she desires?
But this is the interesting thing is that we haven't had CL have a conversation with Mael to understand that, like, has she even asked Mael if this is possible, or is she just sitting back waiting and be like,
I know, but
no,
if a character believes something and they're not asking anyone why, it means that the writers intend for that just to be the way it is and don't ask questions.
Okay.
They use it in everything, you know? It just means, if Ciel is acting confident about it, it means that that's the way this works, and that's their way of telling us, the audience, that that's how this works, you know?
Just on, because that's kind of the story, that's where we're at. We don't know where it's going to end. We've got to go and stop the Renoir that is deleting everybody, essentially. We've got to kind of put a stop to him. That seems to be what the last battle is alluding to. But what it did give us was Esquie, who, anyone listening, is kind of like a creation of Verso's in the painting. He becomes your companion. He's essentially the guy you can walk, you sit on him and he walks around. At one point, he learns how to break through rocks. At another point, he learns how to swim. And at the end of the game, he learns how to fly. So you now have full coverage of the world map, essentially. And we didn't mention it actually at the beginning of the episode, of the spoiler free part, the world map is glorious. It is the old school top down look map at this world system. map system, and you go into dungeons, but it's Just so beautiful.
I bet the guys from who made FF7 went, that's what how we should have done.
That's how we should have done it.
Yeah, we would have saved so much money. Yeah. You know? Yeah. Why didn't we just do turn-based like they did this kind of map system? We could have done it in one game. You know?
Absolutely. But we now have free reign, and that's what I have been really enjoying at the end game. I didn't expect it to have an I didn't expect it to have the level of content that it does, because a lot of the reviews that I watched before I got into the game were, this is going to be a 35-hour game to complete. And I was like, hey, for 50 quid, that seems good. Whatever, I'm fine with that. I'm now at this point where I'm like, holy shit, I can visit everywhere on the world map. There are all these islands in the sky that I could never get to. There's places I wasn't able to fight in because I was too weak. Yeah. And all of a sudden, now the whole world's opened up
to me. So many optional dungeons with loads of dead. And like, just even having one Pictos as a reward is enough for me to want to get that, because it can just drastically
get
change
it,
my
learn
game.
It, and then just, you know, have
I wanna
a whole
know what
new
that
system.
Does. I want to know what that is.
Yeah. Is there anything you want to touch upon?
We mentioned Eske and Minoko. I just think that some of these characters they introduced, like Eske in particular, he sounds just like our friend Daniel. I really hope if Daniel's listening to this, he just plays the game or just looks up a clip of YouTube to see Eske talking to people, because he's just so nice. And like,
it's exactly how Daniel would voice act a character in a game.
It's how Daniel would voice a consoling Daniel would behave in that situation. Yeah. I'm like, oh man, this is absolutely amazing.
Oh, Renoir's bad. Yeah. He's
just so
good.
Kind-hearted and like, but at the same time, he's ridiculously powerful. So there's that element of like, oh, you don't want to mess with this guy, because if you ever turn cross, you really get it. Good thing he's on our side. But it's great because he's this fictional character that's been created by Verso to be this kind of lovely companion to have, you know? Same way Minoko is this like very cool looking and
kind of like
half
Nevron?
No, he's not a Nevron.
He's a Gestrel.
A Gestrel, yeah. So the Gestrels are these like crazy gremlins with these long hair. They look like those troll dolls, you know?
Yeah, and I think they're meant to look like a combination of the mannequins you'd use to draw art. Like, you get those mannequins that have all the parts of the body with muscles that like lots of artists would use to when they're learning to draw art. A mix of them and a paintbrush, and I think that's what the whole vibe was, because that the bristles at the top seem like they would be painting as well, so that you could almost pick them up and paint with them, which I think is a great. But yeah, Minoko is a great character,
and the Gestrels, I think they're like they're like this game's version of fairies, except they're big and they want to fight everything.
Yeah.
But they're like, they always like do kind of silly things, because like, say the writers of the game want us to have some maybe running challenges or something, and it doesn't really make sense in this kind of world to do that. So let's just have the Gestrels set up an obstacle course for
Why wouldn't they?
And because they're mad and off at the fairies a little bit, it's kind of like, yeah,
it
why not?
It fits
I just
the world.
Thought I'd set up this competition here. Why
welcome
not?
Welcome to the beach and enjoy your jumping challenge. Yeah. Yeah, game's great. Voice acting is phenomenally good.
Three of the best voice actors in the business.
Charlie Cox, Star, most recently in Daredevil.
And whatever the girl's name is.
Oh, we should
Shadow
actually.
Heart.
I'm going to.
She is fantastic. I love her in Baldur's Gate 3, and I absolutely love her as Mael. I think she's just portrays emotion so well. And her speech clarity is just. Like, it's not something I usually like pride an actor over, but just. The cadence of her voice is just
Jennifer,
so good.
Jennifer English is her
Jennifer
name.
Jennifer English. Mm-hmm. English is her second name.
Yeah.
Jesus, she's designed to be,
she was born to
fucking do this.
And she is phenomenal. Like, and even like I wouldn't be familiar with the likes of Lune or Ciel, but even Eske, Renoir, they're all supremely enjoyable to listen
and
to.
I imagine the French voice actors are even better.
I must ask you, because Luke, he started playing it on our recommendation as well. He got it on Game Pass, but he's playing through the game in French, given that it's a French studio based in a version of France with the Eiffel Tower. And I must actually ask him how he's getting on with that. But he seems to enjoy it.
I love the English voice acting, but I'm very grateful for the fact that like they'll still, instead of saying French, they'll say mon ami. And like, there are a lot of moments where the characters will, like the Gestrels only speak French.
French.
A lot of the kind of whimsical characters who aren't human will only speak French.
Or like dip in and out of French and English. It's
exactly,
like, a weird jumble of the two.
Like, if they're cursing at someone, they'll curse in French. And I'm like, I love that there's that element.
Yeah.
You know, just to keep us ingrained in the culture.
Yeah.
I know you'll be fighting these mimes, which are very much French, and the music very much goes into
the music's very French, and even the
French accordion the type playing
costumes. Yeah. Like one of Maya's costume is like she's almost like a beret, the striped shirt with the red ribbon scarf, neckerchief, whatever. So lots of the and I love that they've done that. I love that they've taken things that are very much in their world because they're a French studio and created this game that is. I just there's so many parts of that I love. The music, I love the music in that game, and the battle music, even the funky kind of that one that has the very very French motifs in it, but it's all so fabulous. Anything else you'd like to throw in for our review here, Craig, before I ask you for your final
is there anything else we need to touch on story wise where do you think it's all going? Do you have a prediction for how you see this playing out?
Do I have a prediction?
I don't even, like, will there be an Expedition 32, Darren?
So, I don't think there will be an Expedition 32, but I do believe there is the definite bones or a massive foundation for a sequel for this game related to the real world outside the canvas.
Very good.
Because they have these painters and writers that they've discussed who definitely have supernatural powers. And we've only, like, we haven't seen a writer. We've never seen a writer. We've never seen what a writer is capable of doing. We've only seen that mansion in the real world. And that they're able to paint these canvases that, like, you can step into and come to life. And they're at loggerheads with each other. The painters and the writers group aren't getting on. And some people think that the writers tricked my Alicia into setting the fight. Although there's a whole real world scenario that could be a very interesting game concept in itself. Mm-hmm. The way I see it going is that we'll probably go fight Renoir, defeat him, which will allow us to continue living on in the canvas, and you'll get that a version of happily ever after. But to me, there's the bigger question of what the hell's happening outside of this painting. Because whole thing that we've just played.
I hope we don't get that. I hope they really let it stew and then really think creatively about it. Because the more they show us of that world means that that's set in stone. So I'd rather them not show us anything related to that world so that they can really come up with something for the next game and really go at it. Because they probably didn't even know this was going to be a success. So they may have not...
3.3 million copies sold as of the...
Outrageous.
Oh, yeah, 3.3. I think that's what it was. It was 3.3 million copies sold by the 33rd day of its release, given that it's Expedition 33. I thought that was pretty cool.
Impressive stuff.
Final review, Craig. How do you rate this?
If it was a 80... If it had launched at 80 euro... and was and they had been a AAA studio and this was the game they'd come out with, I'd have given it a very high 8 out of 10. Mm-hmm. Mainly because the UI has some issues. There aren't actually a lot of towns to talk to people. Yes. You kind of have the Gestrel Village and you've Lumiere at the
and
start.
And that's it.
And then that's pretty much it. It's pretty much all like dungeons after that kind of thing. So I'd have given it a very high 8 just because it's missing those kind of elements of the towns
the true
that I would associate
big RPGs.
With big RPGs. Yeah. But this is a 50 euro game, Darren.
Yeah,
they didn't need to have half the things that they did, and I still would have given it a 10 out of 10. So for me, it's very easily a 10.
Yeah, yeah, I'm right there with you. It's 10 out of 10. The only complaints I've had throughout the entire game are the UI, which is not even that big of a complaint. It's like, oh, this could have been easier to navigate, but otherwise...
And the fact that there's no map in the dungeons, especially because some of these later dungeons, these optional ones, do you know when you get to like a fork in the road?
Yeah.
And so you take a left, left and you're running for about 30 seconds and then you like...
Is this the right way?
You
should
go
I go?
The platform and it takes you up and I'm like, oh, this must be the right way to go. And I'm like, dang it. So I turn around and I go the other way. And then a minute into that route, I see a save point. I'm like, then this is definitely the right way. So I have to go back again. So like, I often go one way and then chicken out and go back the other way and then end up going back that way again.
See?
And like, I keep like getting into that kind of weird moment where I'm not sure. I always want to go the incorrect way so I'll get the loot.
Yeah.
There's always loot. And there's in this game, there's loot.
There's always
anytime there's a fork in the road, it'll always lead to loot or the right way.
Yeah.
That's just how it works. And this game is full of those.
Yeah.
And there's like every dungeon has about 20 or 30 of those moments where I'm like, is this the right way or is it the loot way? And like, I hate having to like, because sometimes I'll get into a battle and then I just turn, as soon as the fight ends, I'm like, did I come from this way that way? And I'm like,
see, for me, the map thing, as confusing that was sometimes, I really appreciated the fact that our HUD was left. When you're wandering around the world, which is beautifully designed, beautifully lit, art direction is amazing.
Nothing to see.
There is zero on your HUD. There is no information apart from the character running through the world that you're in.
And the gorgeous visuals.
And I love that they've done that. And I love that they've made me not made me, but they've given me the opportunity to just focus on the world that I'm in. Because so often in games with maps, if you're running through a dungeon, you're looking at that screen in the top left or the top right to see. So
sometimes, like, you go into a game, like, graphics mean nothing because all I'm doing is looking at that little mini map.
Yeah, to find out where I'm going.
Learning when I have to turn left and when I have to, and I don't even look up. I don't even know where I am, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, this game forces you to really look around.
And it's worth looking around.
And
it is
worth it. And, like, I do think you should make more games should pull back on the map a bit more because you do get into a habit of just only watching that.
Yeah.
And I massively get, like, I played Final Fantasy VII Rebirth and there's been loads of times where I'm just paying no attention whatsoever to where I am and I'm just focusing on the map. So I think maybe going forward, other games, maybe have a button that you can hold which will make the map pop up very briefly on your screen.
Just to have a
then you let go of the button, it's gone. You know, that type of thing, so that you just have to check it every now and then just to see if I'm going in circles.
Because
in Clair Obscur, there's been many times where I'm like, wait a minute.
I'm definitely lost. I've definitely been here before. Yeah, 10 out of 10. I can't recommend the game enough. I think it's absolutely phenomenal. I'm very curious to see where it goes. I'm also very much looking forward to the tens of hours I still have left to do all the side stuff.
I'm going
to
eat my dinner now and I'm going to play another optional dungeon, hopefully get myself a new Pictos, and then I'm going to spend about 2 hours redesigning my characters based on that new ability.
Excellent. Craig, we got a quick post show after this. I'm going to ask you about midnight launches. I know I haven't briefed you on this at all. But very briefly, we're just going to go through some midnight launches in expectation, because I was talking or checking on Reddit, and Smith's Toy Store, which is the only place we can buy games over here, have a midnight launch for the Switch too.
No.
Yes.
Dang, I'm staying over my girlfriend's that night. Otherwise, I'd be like, let's fucking do it. Let's go.
I'm heading over for to pick up my Switch on midnight on the 4th or whatever. But I thought it'd be a good path to go back on and talk about maybe midnight launches.
That's cool. That's been there rare, before.
Yeah, it doesn't happen much anymore. But if you're interested in that, check out our Patreon, patreon.com/thegiftofgaming, for the cost of a coffee a month. We've got loads of extra shit there. You're going to love it. Craig, thank you so much for hopping on to me with this.
Oh, we still need to talk about this.
Yeah, it's been great. And to our listeners, as always and forever. Wait, what's the?
Enjoy the gift that is gaming.
No, that is the one. For those who come after, keep enjoying the gift that is gaming.
You need to implement that better. Yeah. Start again.
And for those who come after, keep enjoying the gift that is gaming.
Oh, well done. Peace out. So cool.